So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio.
Have you been with us all week for our series on prudence here on Trending? This is the last day of our five-day series on prudence. And if you've missed it, don't worry. We will catch you up next week. We'll have a full podcast put together of the entire series. Just stay tuned. Subscribe to the podcast at relevantradio.com/trending. Today, as we discuss prudence, this is really going to be your prudence crash course for dummies and answering the question that I've received this week of how can you teach prudence to children? Well, the reality is that we all need a crash course in prudence, which we've been doing all week long, but we'll summarize it here on the show, and we'll also even pull from a letter written, actually a homily, from St. Gregory the Great, whose feast day it is today, and he actually talks, by not directly by naming it, but in actuality, about prudence. So stay with us. We'll discuss that and more. Joining me in just a little bit here on the show will be our celebrity and royal matchmaker, Christina Pineda, from Matchmakers in the City, matchmaking us peasant folk as well. And we're going to talk about something maybe you haven't heard of before, and that is thirst traps. What do they have to do with feminism and modesty, and how is it that vast majority of people are engaging in this on social media, especially women? But before we go there, we're going to talk about St. Mother Teresa today, coming up to her feast day this Sunday. I'm so excited. We'll talk about actually a message directly from her. And I don't know if I've shared this on air. My mom actually received a letter from St. Mother Teresa some years ago. So I'll speak a little bit to that as well. But before we go there, lo and behold, I've not quite discussed yet the news coming from Texas and the Supreme Court, which has solicited a vicious response on social media. A vicious response. We are seeing outright intentional comments that portray racism surrounding abortion. That's right. That is right. And you'll see how clear and blatant this is to people who can't even get along, can't even hear one another. And I think the last couple of years have showed something in particular, that everyone's kind of drawing their line in the sand in terms of where they stand on abortion. We saw this with the battle over the last couple of years from New York to Illinois and other states where they wrote into their state constitution that abortion in their state constitution, is permissible through all 9 months of a woman's pregnancy. Why did they do that? In the event that Roe versus Wade is overturned at the Supreme Court level. So what happened this week? Well, you may have followed the news that Texas had passed a law that would essentially officially ban abortion after 6 weeks through a heartbeat law, having to do with banning abortion after a heartbeat is detected. Now, we know that latest studies coming out of Oxford show that that baby's heart is beating by 16 days. But on paper, legally, what we've seen the earliest precedent set yet is in Texas. It has outlawed abortion on paper after 6 weeks. That law took effect September 1st. Now, the Supreme Court of the United States was appealed to by Planned Parenthood and others of the pro-abortion movement, begging them to prevent this from beginning and to make sure that this case was heard. Now, we don't know if this case will be heard at the Supreme Court level. We do know that already a case coming out of Mississippi is going to be heard starting this fall. And it's going to address whether or not abortion, hopefully it will address this, can be banned prior to viability. It'll address also what is considered a, quote, undue burden on a woman to access abortion. Because right now, the 1992 decision of Planned Parenthood versus Casey holds the kind of precedents in terms of what sort of restrictions are and are not allowed to be placed on abortion. On the bright side, Casey versus Planned Parenthood, that Supreme Court case, allowed for restrictions to be placed on it. However, they put this one line in there that no undue burden could be put on a woman. So let's say Texas bans abortion. Well, someone could say, well, this is an undue burden on me as a woman to have access to abortion. So federal law would trump the local state law in this instance. And so if women really push, you could try to get an abortion. So that's kind of where we're at. That said, we haven't had any official, regularly implemented laws banning abortion prior to viability at about 22 weeks gestation. So all of this will continue to be a battle, and it will become even more intense in the next year. But here's what fascinated me. And I think that this is where we have to, yet again, draw a line in the sand. That many people are very upset about this abortion law because they recognize that the vast majority of abortions actually do take place after 6 weeks. Now, a lot of people will say they're for abortion, but just in that first trimester. They're for abortion, but the very, very early stages. Most people don't realize how developed that baby really is. And this is something that we need to have conversations about. Showing images, sharing information, sharing about how the baby can jump, move, and swim all over in utero already at that 6 week mark. How its spinal cord, its nervous system, everything is developing. It just needs a safe environment to continue to be nourished and grow with little fingertips and toes. Its full skeletal system laid out and looked upon. I'll never forget some years ago, I was participating in a lecture series on embryology and the development of the baby in utero. And there was this video shown of a little baby in the womb, in the ultrasound, bouncing off of its mother's, or off of, not technically the mother's wall, but off the amniotic sac. It's bouncing, bouncing, bouncing there within the placenta. That baby was only 6 weeks old. That baby wasn't even bigger than your index finger. That's how small this little baby is. But that baby could bounce and move the way, let's say, you and I could bounce and move on a trampoline with delight and joy. So again, a line in the sand must be drawn. Planned Parenthood, the pro-abortion movement, has been drawing their line in the sand for a while. And that line in the sand has been clear because just about 5 years ago, Texas passed other pro-abortion or pro-life laws. In fact, they weren't even pro-life laws. They were pro-woman, pro-healthcare, that had to do with abortion clinics needing to meet basic ambulatory regulations, basic health standards, from cleanliness standards to fitting a gurney through the hallways and doorways in the event that emergency teams needed to come in with an ambulance to remove a woman who's had problems with treatment there. They also were supposed to have rights to a local hospital, admitting privileges within, I believe it was a 30-mile radius. But the abortion clinics didn't have relationships with the hospitals within 30-mile radius. So what happened is this law was going into effect, and it was going to close almost all the abortion clinics in Texas. Well, Planned Parenthood and other pro-abortion groups such as NARAL and NOW objected. The Supreme Court ended up saying this would place an undue burden on a woman to access abortion. So lo and behold, the abortion clinics remained open after this emergency appeal was made to the Supreme Court. So what did we see in that specific instance? That the pro-abortion movement is so radically pro-abortion that they don't even want to meet basic health standards to keep women safe and basic health standards to help provide proper emergency care. It's all about access to abortion, not about safe, legal abortion. And that's the problem. So here's why we have a problem with part of what President Biden, a so-called Catholic, has said. I'll emphasize, he does not speak for me as a woman, and he does not speak for Catholics. There are two statements that I want to touch on because I think they're very, very important. Number one, He posted on social media saying, "I'm launching a whole of government effort to respond to this decision, looking specifically to HHS and the Department of Justice to see what steps the federal government can take to insulate those in Texas from this law and to ensure access to safe and legal abortion as protected by Roe." I'm sorry, Mr. President, but those people who you're in bed with in terms of money or whatever payoffs or agreements you're making in terms of pro-abortion decisions, well, the reality is you are not helping give access to safe and legal abortion, because your partners in the pro-abortion movement pressured for abortion clinics to stay open when they weren't meeting basic health standards for basic health care for women. You're not pro-woman. Now, here's where it should really upset us. And I saw this statement 2 days ago, and I felt sick to my stomach. And I didn't say anything about it, because I was just kind of letting it sit for a couple days. I wanted to see where things were going. And then a friend texted me last night, and his reading of this was the same as mine, but the verbiage he placed. So I'll tell you what he said in a moment. This is what President Biden said in a statement about Texas' ban on abortion after 6 weeks. He said, "The ban will significantly impair women's access to health care they need. Listen here. Particularly for communities of color and individuals with low incomes." What did he just say? Think about it for a moment. I'll repeat that last statement. That this would impact and that they need access to abortion, particularly communities of color and individuals with low income. My friend wrote to me and said he basically just said that colored and poor people should die. That's what he said. That's what abortion is. It's eugenics. It is population control. It is intentional population control. Why is it that the pro-abortion movement pushes so hard for people of low income and in minority communities to have access to abortion? You read between the lines. This facade about BLM and everything that they keep trying to champion, it's a facade to distract us from the reality of a movement they have been involved in since its inception. And that is the eugenics movement, which Margaret Sanger, the founder of Planned Parenthood, is known well and admired for her mission to create a race, as she says, of thoroughbreds. And with her hope that specifically the black community wouldn't catch on. We have to tell the truth. We have to draw a line in the sand. Abortion is population control. Abortion hurts women. Abortion is eugenics. An abortion destroys the life of a baby. And we need to say it over and over again. Don't participate in the yelling and screaming matches. Tell your story. Tell the truth. Share ultrasound images. Share the miracles of the lives saved and your children who have made it to term because you chose life. The only difference between your child and the other children who don't make it is that one's wanted and one's unwanted. We need to continue to tell that narrative. There's no difference. One is wanted and one is unwanted. And some of these babies are unwanted even by people such as our president, who basically just said, "Colored and poor people should die," as a friend of mine put it to me in a text last night. That's what he said when he emphasized the need for abortion for colored communities and individuals with low income. Draw your line in the sand and encourage others to as well. Are you going to stand for the culture of life, as Pope St. John Paul II spoke of, or the culture of death? We can't make excuses anymore for people who use statements such as these and false and poor arguments. It has nothing to do with safe abortion. It has nothing to do with health care, and it should not and cannot be legal. And thank God for those who have voted and supported such measures in Texas. Pray for our Supreme Court as they hear a very precedent-setting case surrounding Mississippi and blocking abortion in the years to come. I'll be right back here on Trending. You're listening to me on Relevant Radio. Joining me in just a minute will be Christina Pineda from Matchmakers in the City. Do you know what thirst traps are? We'll discuss that in light of feminism and modesty. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
So, what's trending? Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
You're joining us during our series on prudence. We'll get to that in just a little bit. Wrapping up the fifth day of this series, we'll talk about prudence for dummies and how to teach prudence to your kids. Joining me now is Christina Pineda. She is the founder and one of the matchmakers with her company, Matchmakers in the City, matchmaking everyone from us peasants to even having matchmade royals and celebrities. Today, we're going to discuss thirst traps. Do you know what these are? I had no idea yet. It seems to be a trend apparently in the social media world having to do with getting attention, getting dates, and trying to trap the person you're looking for. So, Christina, what exactly is a thirst trap?
Hi, Timory. I know I hadn't heard of it before either, but my sister told me about it, and it's huge in the social media world. And it's become just the common relationship power play. I think people have been doing it for years, but I don't know if they've known that they've been doing it for years. It means that when someone posts a photo of herself, it's usually a woman, and she's wearing less than she should to get the attention of a man or a member of the opposite sex. So men can do it too, but it's usually most common with women.
So let's see. I think that anyone who has had social media or grew up with social media at some point has probably used some form of a thirst trap, either through posting on social media or even just with texting, or we could even say sexting. Now, is there a difference between sexting and thirst trapping?
Yes. Thirst trapping is more of a public way of doing it. So for instance, a good example would be you haven't heard from a guy in a while. So you post on, he follows you on Instagram and you post a photo of yourself in a bikini. And then he texts you because he saw that photo of you looking gorgeous and you got his attention. So that is what the outcome a lot of women might want if they want to get the attention of a man. It's not at the level of sexting. It's more of a a taste of what they would get rather than the whole thing. So it's just, yeah, I would say it's probably better.
It's on the
sexting,
verge.
But
yeah,
it's still not.
It is. It is on the verge, though. It is on the verge. Right. And I mean, the other thing I think for women, for us to understand and see in our behavior, if this is something you've done or something you are doing, know that this is actually bad for you in the sense that it is manipulation. And if you feel like that's the only way you can reach the person you're looking for, you shouldn't have to use your body in that type of way. And so let's talk about this. You're a matchmaker. You work with helping people find love, get married, try out dates. Does thirst trapping work in the long term or the short term?
Right. So for the short term, it might work. And I've heard situations where it has worked to get that attention. But as you said, it's not the right kind of attention. And this is not a man who you'd want to spend more of your time with, because clearly if you have to do somersaults and actually degrade yourself to get his attention, it's not the right person for you. That's not the man who God wants for you. And funny little matchmaker secret I will let you in on. Most of our members don't get to see photos before they go on a date. And there is, however, a small percentage of men who do pay for photo add-ons where they do get to see a few photos of a woman before they go on a date. And we've seen through all the years of doing this that if the women send us photos of themselves that they want to be, it's always the woman giving us photos they want to show. But if it's a woman who maybe sent us a bikini photo and we put that in there, The guy, most of the men say no to the photos that are more revealing, and they say yes to the photo cards that are the more covered up. Women are more covered up. And this is not just for Catholic men. We work with all different kinds of religions and people who are non-religious, but men have a, when they're looking for the woman they want to marry, they have an idea that this is a woman who I want to have more of that conservative view of how she shows her body. So just something for everyone to know.
And this is something that fascinates me, Christina, because time and time again, I've seen this play out. Like you said, it doesn't matter if someone's Catholic, if someone's even a player, often they actually prefer at the end of the day that the woman is more respectable in how she presents her body. Now, it could be for selfish reasons. He doesn't want other men looking at his girlfriend, or it could be out of a sense of respect for her or desiring to respect her as well.
And I don't even think they know what it really is, but it right. is this ingrained in them that they want to be with someone who has that self-respect for her body. And that's where it comes in. I wanted to share a story of myself, and I haven't shared this in detail with many other people, but when I was in college, I did post a photo of myself when I went to this Playboy party. I don't know why I did it, but I'm a different person now. So it was not at the Playboy Mansion. It was at a frat house. And I got dressed up and I took a photo and I posted it on Facebook. And I wanted to get attention, definitely wanted to get male attention. But one of my friends from high school wrote a comment and she said something that really struck me and really upset me in the moment. And I was saying, oh, she's not my friend. But she said, wow, I thought you were a feminist. I'm disappointed. And it really made me stop in my tracks and think about, should I have posted that photo? I ended up taking it down and it really changed my life. But this doesn't even, of course, we want to be respect or have self-respect for our bodies. But whatever kind of woman you are, even if you consider yourself a feminist, it's problematic for that as well.
Yeah, I think that this is a challenge because a lot of women who talk about having confidence or wanting their daughters to have confidence sometimes sacrifice that when it comes to how they dress and selling their bodies. I know a lot of women who I highly, highly respect who even themselves dress modestly, but then they want their kids to, quote, fit in or be with the current style or not have a hard time finding clothes. And so they let their kids wear things that are easy, essentially, easy socially or easy when it comes to shopping. And we can do this with ourselves as well. Yet, is that really women's empowerment? Is that helping our daughters to set a precedence for how they will view themselves and how others will view and treat them at the end of the day? And I think that this is what this whole thirst trapping comes back around to, is it's all about not just how others perceive us, but how we perceive ourselves in order to get another person's attention. And that's really concerning.
That's completely true. And I want to bring up the French feminist scholar Luce Irigaray. She came up with this concept of the market. And the market, a lot of people know the marriage market. You could think of the dating market. But she really spelled it out in her book, Women on the Market, that she wrote in 1985. And she talked about how women are valued and sold by superficial market standards. But what really was the driving point of this was that women are doing it and perpetuating it themselves. So yes, this market may be in place and some women may say, oh, that's patriarchy. No, by posting these photos, by dressing in that way, women are actually fueling it. And then women put themselves in unnecessary competition with each other for men. It's very competitive. Love, I tell all of the women who I work with, is not a competition. And if a woman can take a man from you, she should have him. You do not want to be a man with a man who you have to compete with other women for and compete for his attention. So this is all to say that women, through thirst trapping, are actually commodifying themselves. And as a result, your value is not found within yourself. It's based on these superficial standards that we ourselves are playing into if we do these things.
I love this conversation because I actually hate talking about modesty because people become very uptight. I myself can become very uptight. I've had people be extremely judgy in the wrong circumstances with clothing, and then people not give enough feedback in other circumstances with clothing. You know, I grew up in Southern California. I grew up on a lake. You know, everything from bikinis to the dancing world I grew up in, a lot of skin was a norm, to say the least. And so developing a sense of modesty and not seeking attention based on less clothing was a challenge for me, just like I think it is for many women. Now, I think, Christina, there's a difference between dressing nicely, dressing even to make a statement, dressing to even dress well so that you're respected and maybe even receive attention. But there's a problem if we're using too much skin over the nice clothing we're wearing. I think that's a big difference. What are your thoughts?
I think so too. And it's so true. The term modesty is really misunderstood and undervalued. It's cringeworthy. It is. And a lot of women, unfortunately, have been the victims of hearing people say, oh, you look inappropriate in the wrong way, and talking to them in the wrong way about it. And actually, the pastor at my church had put a letter in one of the bulletins saying that it's no one's job to criticize what a woman is wearing. And he said that we have an internal monitor. So I go to mass and I may not be wearing the most conservative thing, then I might feel awkward. And then I will change that next time I go. I'm not the only woman who has this. We all do. So listen to that when you know what is appropriate and you know what isn't. So it doesn't mean you have to have these exact standards of the skirt has to be 5 inches longer than your knee. I don't think it's a specific thing like that. It's more of listen to the Holy Spirit, because modesty is a virtue that he will give you, and he will continue to lead you into how to exhibit that modesty. And it's in the Bible too. And just, we know that our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit. And that means we're actually arks of the covenant that house the Holy of Holies. I thought about that and I said, wow, that's amazing. And because St. Paul talks about this in the first letter to the Corinthians, that those parts of the body that we consider less honorable, we surround with greater honor, and our less presentable parts are treated with greater propriety, whereas our more presentable parts do not need this. So this is a Bible passage to really pray upon and meditate on, that, wow, there's so much holiness in me. It's not that I need to cover it up out of shame. It's that I have the Holy Spirit within me, and I need to guard that. So more of seeing it in a positive modesty, in a positive way, rather than a negative way.
I really agree. And I think some guidelines to go by, and I'd love to hear what feedback you might give to your clients who you coach and date coach. But some things that I've always followed, Christina, and if you're just joining us, that's Christina Pineda. She's a celebrity and royal matchmaker based out of Los Angeles, joining us here on Trending. And my big rules, number one, is place. I always try to make sure that I'm dressed appropriately for the place I'm going. And that also might mean a particular occasion. You know, I think that, you know, we can recognize this based on who we're around. I'll give an example for me personally. I've had to really change my wardrobe over the last few years, because the reality is a lot of the work that I've been doing has either been in a Pilates studio teaching from a fitness perspective, or in a professional way, or it's been within the church context, speaking at events, going to events, organizing meetings. And so the more relaxed clothing I'd wear that maybe aren't as strict, and I'm not saying immodest, but not as strict with what I'd wear, I can't wear all the time. And so I've had to really revamp my wardrobe because the vast majority of people I spend time around are people who I need to make sure I am a little more professional, a little more presentable. You know, me going to the beach and wearing shorts and a t-shirt doesn't work if I'm going to speak in an event. So I think dressing for the place and even the people you're going to be around is very important. And having purpose with that, but also always say for comfort. You mentioned this with masks. Like, you know, your conscience kicks in. You're like, I probably should have worn something a little longer, not so high of a slit, not quite as form-fitted, whatever it might be. But also comfort in terms of, do I feel like I'm wiggling all the time, having to pull my skirt down, yank my shirt up? You know, this changes based on the state of life we're in. You know, depending on where you're at location-wise, what people you're around. All of these things, I think, help to form a modesty framework that isn't saying, okay, make sure that you're, you know, four fingers away from your collarbone or all the way to the knee. I think that that really has to be more flexible in terms of how and where we're at.
Yes, I completely agree with that framework, Timri. I think that's really just practical advice that we all should, all women should go by, and men should too, because men want to dress appropriately for where they're going. And it's good for everyone to think about these things, to be thoughtful about what we wear. And I guess with the thirst trapping and women thinking that it's going to give them more power, and they may post something and in the moment think, okay, I won now. I got him to text me. But if you've ever taken a basic acting class, for instance, the person screaming is the one who has the least power. So if you have to do all of this to feel like you have power, it's actually showing that you have less power, and you have more power when you show less of yourself. So the problem with doing these things and thinking and valuing yourself on your beauty too is that you start believing that you are only valuable because you're pretty and you have these gorgeous photos of yourself that people are liking on Instagram. And that way we're actually becoming like Pharisees, who the Lord calls are like whitewashed tombs. Beautiful on the outside, but filthy on the inside. So even if it's just one photo, our consciences get numb to it. And then little by little, we lose ourselves and we forget what our true value is. So just think about those things. Some of the recent daily mass readings from the Gospel of Matthew have been about the Pharisees and appearances versus reality. I think this is so important for us living in this social media world where, unless it's been on Instagram, it doesn't count, where you need to know that, no, that's not where your value comes from, that your value comes from being a princess, a daughter of the Lord. And to dial back and to get in tune with that, ask yourself that question, why am I posting this, before you post anything? And think about who your audience is too. Timri was saying, made a great point. Where am I going? Think about who is your audience when you're doing social media. Think about the women, the young girls who might be following you, who you are an example to. Maybe you babysat them when you were younger. Maybe think about your future children. What do you want them to see of you? This is public. So just some thoughts.
We really kind of took to something you said a moment ago. You were talking about how in acting class, the person who yells loudest has the least power. And you also use that in comparison to thirst trapping. When you give yourself away, you don't have that much power. And there's a book written by Mark Rignaris, a social scientist, titled Cheap Sex. And he basically made clear that women are the gatekeepers of sex. They're yes or no. And when we post various pictures on social media that are participating in this thirst trapping, we're saying that we're easy. And we're also saying that we're probably going to say yes to requests for the very serious pressure women now experience and that men think is okay to solicit with sexting and requests for photos and conversations that don't go, that don't help us go anywhere, but only lead to heartbreak. And so I think all of this is important to remember when we're talking about thirst trapping. It may seem like it's just a simple photo to get his attention, but it's so much more than that in the big context of things. That's Christina Pineda from Matchmakers in the City. What couple tips do you give to your clients that you're matchmaking when it comes to clothing?
Well, we say you want to wear something that is for date looks, that is attractive to the opposite sex, but is conservative still. So for women, we recommend for a first date night look, a form-fitting dress that is, but it's not revealing. So it doesn't show up top, and it doesn't show too much a leg. And then you wear heels that elongate, nude heels that elongate your legs, or whatever your skin color is, heels that you that elongate your legs. So you want something that is, and then also you can play around with the colors. We say little black dress, but it can be whatever color you feel comfortable in. And then having something that you get a sweater, something that you can put over it if it's cold, and also just depending on how you're feeling during the date. But you need to feel confident in what you're wearing and that this is showing your body in a way that's respectful for yourself and you don't feel like you're overexposing yourself. So always keep that in mind for women. And for men, we like to just say also form fitting is good. Not completely form fitting, but we don't want
please,
our men in
no
big
skinny
baggy
jeans,
clothes.
Gentlemen. Please, okay. I can't. Even if Christina says it, I can't.
But they could go the opposite direction, and some men just have these huge baggy clothes, and it looks terrible. And they're in such good shape, so you need something that fits you well, which is hard to find. That's why we work with a stylist who helps the men and the women get the right fit. But especially for the guys, you want to wear something that is, I guess it depends on the restaurant.
That's
so
another
we say,
conversation we've had, but I do love it when you talk about telling the guys not to wear clown shoes. I'm all about not wearing clown shoes, having a little bit of a point to the shoe. We'll actually post a link to the past shows where we've actually talked about how to dress, gentlemen, if you are going on a date. You're listening to Trending with Timory. That's been Christina Pineda. She's a celebrity and royal matchmaker, joining us regularly here on Trending. You can find her and her work at matchmakersinthecity.com. We'll include a link in the show notes at relevantradio.com/trending. Coming up, St. Mother Teresa's feast day is Sunday. Let's talk about her. Let's hear from her. And we'll continue our series on the virtue of prudence.
Bridging your Catholic faith with your everyday life. You're listening to Trending with Timory on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Sunday is the feast day of St. Mother Teresa. That is the 5th of September. And St. Mother Teresa has a near and dear place in my heart for a number of reasons. From the fact that she is a modern day saint, having died recent enough for us to have known many people who knew her. In fact, my mom received a letter from St. Mother Teresa some years ago the wisdom from that letter I know has had great influence in the life of my mom and now me for many years. I've shared before that my parents, when I was just a little girl, practically a baby toddler, opened up a maternity home for women who were in crisis pregnancy. They could come, live there, have a safe haven for birthing, raising their baby for a little while, be given the resources, training, help they need to get back up on their own two feet. And for a time, there's no one to physically run the home. And so my parents closed up our house and moved us into running the home, this maternity home for a time. And when my parents founded the maternity home, known as Veronica's Home, they had some various people who had engagements with Mother Teresa, who they told Mother Teresa about what was going on, and Mother Teresa, now a saint, wrote a letter to my mom about what was being done. And the thing that has always stood out to me in that letter, even with, you know, all the compliments for pro-life work and helping women in need, is she would speak of the West, Western civilization, and how we are not experiencing a red martyrdom here in the West, that is, such as our brothers and sisters in the all over the Middle East, the Chaldean Catholics, the Maronite Catholics, the Lebanese, and so forth. Christians all over the Middle East are literally being persecuted in China, in Afghanistan, in Lebanon, you name it. Being killed, being beheaded, kidnapped. And in the West, we don't experience that. Although we are under a new state of persecution that continues to grow, we do experience what's referred to as a white martyrdom. That martyrdom where we are punished by our culture, by our neighbors, our friends, our family members, or maybe we are even just punished for the good choices that we make, separating ourselves out from various practices that are harmful. And even thinking just of things, for example, such as financially investing, you know, the various types of stocks and companies we invest in, whether they're participating in virtuous versus non-virtuous actions, and whether or not we can participate in funding and investing in that particular company and profiting from it. There's so much for us to think about prudentially, and we'll come to prudence in just a minute here. But I want to challenge us as we approach the feast day of St. Mother Teresa of Calcutta, that we think about how am I living out that white martyrdom? Because I think there is something wrong if we are not familiar with, or if we don't understand St. Mother Teresa's words on this, if we don't understand that there's a separation between good and evil in the world, light and darkness. And we need to decide which side we will stand on. And we need to know where to run when we struggle to stand on the right side, on the side of truth, on the side of light, in the life of Christ. That is reconciliation. And so let's ponder St. Mother Teresa's words and encouragement. And in fact, I want to take a short excerpt here from a great speech from St. Mother Teresa of Calcutta that we'll play here now for you. Listen to this great saint whose words and image we can see and hear.
Where does this love begin? In our own family, in our own home. How does it begin? By praying together. Family that prays together stays together. And if you stay together, you will love one another as God loves each one of you. Today, in the world, there's so much suffering because of that one of prayer, of unity in the family. So today, when we are together, let us make one strong resolution that we will bring prayer in our family, that we will teach our children to pray and pray with them. And you will see the joy and the love and the peace that will come into your hearts. Because the fruit of prayer is the deepening of faith. And the fruit of faith is love. And the fruit of love is service. And the fruit of service is peace. Works of love are works of peace.
Those are the words of the great Saint Mother Teresa of Calcutta. I can't believe I was just listening to this saint's voice. I love to read, and I'll read and read and read the messages of the saints. But there's an image, there's a voice, there's sound. We're able to take her in our senses in such a beautiful way. This little nun from Calcutta. There aren't many, as Patrick just said, there aren't many saints where we can actually hear their voices. And I want you to really ponder and pray and listen. Maybe re-listen to this podcast and the words from St. Mother Teresa of Calcutta, relevantradio.com/trendy, if you want to re-listen. She, in this specific speech, is talking about the family and praying together and the importance of this. That a family, as we've heard time and time again over the last 15, 20 years, a family that prays together stays together. We hear these pithy sayings that sound nice, but are we taking them into our homes, into our marriages, into our families, into whatever dwellings we live in, that we are having a place of prayer with those who we're living in community with. And this is what builds unity. This is what bears fruit. This is what bears charity, love in our lives. Bring prayer into the family. This is the message of St. Mother Teresa of Calcutta. We have to pray for her intercession that we might be prepared to be white martyrs in this country that we live in, and possibly even red martyrs, martyrs who endure death in a sacrificial way that could lead to a bloody martyrdom. She had such a radical form of love that it was transformative. And I remember there's a story I've heard that's always stuck with me, that a reporter was talking to her and he's asking her, you know, Mother, how do you do what you do? And she grabbed his hand rather aggressively for this little nun. And she said, if I for one moment took my eyes off of that cross, I would not be able to do anything that I do. Anything that I do. And this is important because we are continuing our series on prudence. And St. Mother Teresa told that reporter that if you were to take your eyes off of the cross, if she were to take her eyes off of the cross for 1 second, she would not be able to do the things that she was doing. Making the sacrifices, cleaning the wounds, picking people up off of the streets, embracing the sick and the filthy and everything that she went through. She wouldn't have balked the way we balk in the face of current illnesses in our nation, in our crises we're experiencing. Where would she be in all of this? She wouldn't be running in the other direction. I can guarantee that. And so as people are asking me, as we're wrapping up this series on prudence, one of the biggest questions I've received is, how do we teach prudence to our children? This is a fantastic question. And so this last part of our series on prudence is prudence for dummies. And I'm not talking about kids. I'm talking about all of us, because Jesus Christ reminds us to be like little children. Time and time again, he would remind his apostles by picking up a child, placing the child on his lap, to be like the little ones, not to scandalize them. So briefly in review, what is the virtue of prudence? It's one of the four cardinal virtues. St. Thomas Aquinas refers to it as right reason applied to action. And there are three acts of prudence that we're supposed to engage in. As he says, counsel, judgment, and command, commanding our actions. One way of putting it a little simpler, again, this is prudence for dummies during this last segment, is one, to think about things with counsel, to decide based on what we've thought and received in counsel, and then to act upon it. Think, decide, act. Those are three simple things that can be taught to a child. What do we need to do, and what do children need to learn when it comes to taking a course of action? First of all, to stop and think. To not just dive into things without pondering. Our Lady provided a model of pondering things in her heart. Second, after we've recognize that we have to stop and think, we need to make sure that feelings are not the determining factor in our decisions. They can be a part of a deciding factor, but not the determining factor. A great example of this, I was actually thinking about it the other day. My baby girl bonked her head on the table the other day. And someone told her to whack the table. Just whack the table. That table hurt you. Hit the table. That bad table. Hit the table. And I went, oh, no, 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 no. That's not something I want to teach. Why? Well, because I don't want her to think that because I'm mad and angry and I hurt, that I can just have this visceral reaction that I'm going to hit what hurt me. Because someone could accidentally bump into her one day and she punches them in the face because she learned that it was okay to hurt and hit and kick and be mad at what hurt her, potentially accidentally. Now, if someone actually hurt her, and let's say harmed her in a way, she should be able to stop and think not just about whether or not to hit the person back, but where to hit him and where would be most effective. That would be prudence, because first she stopped and thought, and second, she had control over her feelings, not allowing them to be the deciding factor in her action. What else should we teach to ourselves and kids when it comes to prudence? Context. Know the difference between something that's permissible and appropriate in a proper context. Proportionate means to choosing our ends. As I discussed before, at the beginning of our series, we may know universally that a chair is meant to be sat on, but let's say we're in an environment where we need heat. We need to cook food. The only option to do that is over an open fire, and the only option we have is a wooden chair. It would be prudential to choose to chop the chair down and burn it, not to wait for someone to come around and sit on it. I gave other examples as well that we could work through, but again, it's knowing context, knowing the difference between what's permissible and appropriate. Third, teach our kids to consult God. That is first praying, but second, understanding the magisterium, which is upheld by sacred scripture, knowing our scripture, and the living tradition of the church, the example of the saints, how the sacred scriptures are interpreted. And finally, teaching our kids to learn from others by observation. This we too can work on. So what's our crash course and conclusion, simplifying the virtue of prudence? It's how to choose a course of action by thinking, deciding, and acting. To stop and think. Don't let our feelings be the determining factor. Discover the context and what's appropriate. And learn from others by observation. And always make an informed decision in prayer. Join us next week as we continue a series on virtue.